Hi, thank you so much for joining us today on Modern Tech News on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. Our guest today is Stanford professor Bruce Clemens. Professor Clemens teaches material science, and his research group focuses on inventing new materials to advance solar cells and to help make them much more economically. In today's show, Professor Clemens will talk about how the new inorganic materials that he and his group are working on will improve solar cells, and he will also talk about nanomaterials. He'll describe what they are and why they are important. In our show today, Professor Bruce Clemens will also discuss why we need to use more solar cells. As you will hear later on in the show, Professor Clemens has calculated that today our global oil consumption can fill a huge lake the size of Lake Tahoe with oil every 4 days. Obviously, this is an enormous amount of oil. In today's show, Professor Clemens will discuss the new solar cell research that he's focusing on. He will also tell us how the processes that they are using in the lab can be used in industry. And as a matter of fact, one of his students was able to take one of the lab processes that they used to make thin film solar cells and turn it into an industrial process at the company he now works for. Professor Clemens will also talk to us about the research that his group does in hydrogen storage and their work on transistor gate materials and why those are very important now as the size of the transistors gets smaller. There are different types of solar cells, and in today's show, Professor Clemens will talk about why thin film solar cells are more efficient than organic ones. Organic solar cells, for example, are now being used by the city of San Francisco to light up the bus stops. So next time you drive in San Francisco, you'll notice that the bus stops have a red plastic cover. These are solar cells that are organic. They are manufactured by a company called Konarka near Boston. In today's show, Professor Clemens will point out the difference between the organic solar cells, like the ones that will cover San Francisco's bus stops, and the thin film solar cells that the Clemens group is working on at Stanford. In the second half of today's show, Professor Clemens will talk about his very popular course, Solar Cells, Fuel Cells, and Batteries. This online course has more than 10,000 students. Professor Clemens will tell us how the idea of this course started. He mentions later on in the show that even though we will be having more online classes, that there is much more to a Stanford education than just the classes. At the end of the show, Professor Clemens, who is also the president of the prestigious Materials Research Society for this year, will talk about the society's plans to deliver knowledge and courses and conferences to different parts of the world, and why it's important to have science outreach and increased two-way communication in science education. Thank you again for joining us today. Our show is Modern Tech News, and now it's time for our PSA. On Wednesday afternoon, October 24th at 4:30 p.m., the Friends of Music at Stanford present the St. Lawrence String Quartet in a free concert for string students in grades 4 through 12. Although targeted towards string students, any student interested in music will find the program rewarding. That's Wednesday afternoon, October 24th at 4:30 p.m. for this free concert in Dinkelspiel Auditorium by the St. Lawrence String Quartet. Hi, our guest, Professor Bruce Clemens, will now talk to us about why thin film solar cells are important, and he will also talk to us about what nanomaterials are and why they are important.
Most solar cells these days are made out of chunks of silicon that are processed and then sawed up and made into solar cells. Those solar cells work pretty well, but they're expensive and they cost a lot of energy to make. So the advantage of thin film solar cells is you can deposit the materials efficiently onto a wider variety of substrates and use less material and make them more economical. The trick is to get them to be as efficient as the silicon solar cells. And that's what my group and I are working on, is to try to make them equally as efficient or even more efficient so that they can be economically viable and save space on people's roofs and use less of what's called the balance of system, and thereby reducing the cost even further. The least expensive solar cells to make are still thin film solar cells. They would be even better if their efficiencies could be higher. So that's the trick now, is to try to figure out ways to make thin film solar cells that have efficiencies that rival the silicon solar cells.
Hi, this is Modern Tech News, and our guest is Professor Bruce Clemens, who teaches materials research and material science at Stanford University. Professor Clemens will now describe the materials that they use to make thin film solar cells.
There's a wide variety of materials that people are thinking of. In my group, we're looking at a material that's we call CZTS, and several other groups in the world are looking at it too, but it has copper, zinc, tin, and sulfur, and sometimes a little bit of selenium in it. This material is potentially very inexpensive because it's made out of all inexpensive elements and very earth-abundant elements. The challenge there is to try to make a really good solar cell, and our group right now is close to the record in around a little under 10%. We want to double that, and we have plans to work towards doing so. We are getting to the point where we need to demonstrate an increased efficiency, and we've been looking at some of the fundamental aspects of the material, looking at its grain boundaries and the effect of the grain boundaries, and it seems as though the material has good potential for being highly efficient, but no one in the world's yet realized that potential. So we're still learning about the material, learning why it is falling short, and if we determine that we can never get a high efficiency with this material, we'll at least learn what are the characteristics that cause it not to be highly efficient as a solar cell material, and that will guide us towards choosing new materials that don't have that particular characteristic.
I asked Professor Clemens to mention the name of the material they're working on one more time and to tell us how this material is made.
It's copper, zinc, tin, and sulfur, and selenium. We call it CZTS. It's deposited by a number of different ways. The best efficiency was achieved by a group at IBM, and they use a solution-based process that involves hydrazine, which is a very explosive material used as rocket fuel, so it's not thought to be a manufacturable process. The technique we use is known as sputter deposition, and it's a technique that's widely used for a lot of economic and technological products, including coating the inside of potato chip bags with metals, but also in high-tech industries such as the silicon industry and glass coating industries as well. The way it works is we put the material that we want to deposit in the same chamber as the substrate or the material that we want to deposit it on, and then we pump out almost all the air and then let in just a little bit of an inert gas. We use argon, but there's other gases that you can use. And then we do what's called striking a plasma, which is just a highly excited state of the inert gas atoms that turns them into ions so that they're charged. And then we accelerate those ions towards the chunk of material we want to deposit. They go slamming into that chunk of material and knock out atoms, and those atoms go off and stick to our substrate. And that's the process is known as sputter deposition.
Recently, there has been research on solar textiles, and this made me ask Professor Bruce Clemens if we could use this sputter technique on a pair of jeans.
Yes, you could sputter deposit onto a pair of jeans, and people sputter deposit on all different types of materials. The trick with this solar cell material is that even though the process itself can be deposited on a wide variety of substrates, in order to form the right phase of the material, the right crystallographic structure with the right arrangement of atoms, we need to heat it up. And so we have to heat it at at pretty high temperatures so that your genes would not survive those high temperatures. But other substrates will, and including glass and other inexpensive substrates.
My next question was, can we use this technique on transparent glass and then use that transparent glass as a window and a solar cell at the same time?
Yeah, you could use it that way, although for a really good solar cell, you need to absorb all the light. So it wouldn't be a good window because you wouldn't be able to see through it. If you wanted to have a solar cell that wasn't quite as efficient, you could only absorb part of the light, and you could make the film as thin as you want then to absorb the fraction of the light that you wish to absorb. And that way you could have a window that was a solar cell and you could see through as well. So certainly these materials are amenable to that process. Right now the device structure has a metal on the bottom for the back contact to extract out the carriers that are produced by the sunlight. So you'd have to change that aspect of it too if you wanted to make a transparent solar cell.
Now that we have built the solar cell, what do we do with the energy? Do we need to use it right away, or is it more efficient to store it in a battery, for example?
The energy used in processing is fairly small compared to the conventional solar cell manufacturer. And then in the operation of the solar cell, it could be used in any of the ways that any type of solar cell is used. And it could be used, for instance, on people's roofs or in large-scale installations or in systems where people are off the grid and they're producing electrical power for their house, and then they have a storage system as well to use that power later on. Most photovoltaic applications, though, are ones that feed into the grid. For example, on our house, we have a solar system on our roof that's tied into the grid, and we produce power during the day when the sun's out and then feed that into the grid, and it goes to other electricity users. And then at night, when we need electrical power, we pull power back out of the grid. And on our particular installation, on a yearly average, we make more electricity than we use.
My next question was, what kind of metal are those thin film solar cells deposited on?
Well, the backing right now, we're using molybdenum, and that's just a choice that other people are using. It's not clear that that's the best, and in fact, we're starting to explore using other metals for the back contact because it turns out that the properties of that, in terms of its chemical properties and also its electrical properties, turn out to be important for the solar cell.
Thank you so much for joining us today on Modern Tech News. Our guest, Professor Bruce Clemens, teaches materials research and material science at Stanford University. We've been discussing thin film solar cells, which will reduce the cost of solar cells in the near future and make them much more economical than photovoltaic cells. To summarize the topic, Professor Clemens will now tell us the materials that they use to make the thin film solar cells, as well as the metal that they use for the backing.
Yeah, so it's copper, zinc, tin, and sulfur, and selenium, CZTS, and then molybdenum, or MO, is the back metal that we're using. And then there's, in the device stack, there's a lot of other materials that are used as well, including a transparent conductive oxide material. And we're using aluminum doped zinc oxide. Its short name is AZO. It's an interesting material because it's both transparent and it conducts electricity.
I wanted to know how big the solar cells that they made in the lab were.
Well, the ones we make in our research lab are quite small. We don't have the type of machines that will eventually be used in production. But they use this process that is easily transferable to production. And in fact, one of my students worked in my group and went off to work for a local company, and he developed the ability to grow this material in a production environment.
At the beginning of today's show, I mentioned that there were organic solar cells and the thin film solar cells, which Professor Bruce Clemens is working on. My question now was, what are the pros and cons of organic and thin film solar cells?
I'm biased. I work on inorganic solar cells. But I think organic solar cells have the potential to be used on a wider range of substrates because their processing tends to be at lower temperatures. So maybe if you did want to coat your blue jeans, the organic solar cells would be the way to go. They tend not to have as good a lifetime because the molecules that are excited by the sun also tend to be degraded by that process of being excited by the sun, and they're very sensitive to exposure to air. And they also haven't demonstrated quite as high efficiency as inorganic thin film solar cells have. So the advantages to inorganic materials are lifetime and efficiency. And when you're talking about a big installation or even a rooftop installation, efficiency is important because in a solar cell installation, you need not just the solar cells, but you need a glass covering and you need rack mounts and you need connector strips and wires. And all those sorts of things kind of scale with the size of the system. And if you can make solar cells more efficient, then you can make a smaller system which produces the same amount of power and therefore doesn't require the same amount of material and cost associated with what's called the balance of system. And so efficiency is very important for economic application of solar cells. So far, inorganic has greater efficiency than the organics. And we hope to increase it even further.
Before leaving thin film solar cells, I asked Professor Clemens to describe the future plans for how to make thin film solar cells more efficient.
Well, we're trying to understand the limitations of our current materials and devices thoroughly so that we can look at what processes are leading to loss of efficiency. And so far, we've studied very carefully the properties of the grain boundaries in these materials, and it seems that in many materials, the grain boundaries can be the limiting characteristic of a material because that's where you can lose the carriers that are excited by the sun. But we don't think that's happening in our materials. We're afraid that it may be associated with other types of defects that we're just starting to study now in our materials, point defects and secondary phases. And we're also looking at doing a more careful design of the solar cell itself, involving careful atomic scale manipulation of the composition in order to make a more efficient solar cell design. And so those are the areas that we're looking at to try to understand this material so that we can make a more efficient solar cell.
Our guest, Professor Bruce Clemens, who teaches materials research and material science at Stanford University, also works on nanomaterials. I asked Professor Clemens to describe what are nanomaterials and why are they important.
In our work on nanostructured materials, we're looking at a variety of different things. And one of the things we're looking at is hydrogen storage materials. And there we're looking at how changing the size of a material can change its chemical properties. And in hydrogen storage materials, you react the material with hydrogen to form a hydride. And you need to be able to tune the thermodynamics and kinetics of that reaction in order to make a good hydrogen storage material. And so we're using size to try to tune those characteristics of the reaction. So to do that, we've developed a piece of equipment in our lab where we can produce nanoparticles, which are just a 1 to several nanometers in diameter of a huge range of materials. And we're looking at these for hydrogen storage, but also for other applications, for instance, catalysis in solar fuel production. So as you mentioned, one of the disadvantages with photovoltaics is they produce power that needs to be used right away or stored. Another option for utilizing sunlight is to have a device which makes a fuel of some kind. For example, if you could use sunlight to split water, then you could split water into oxygen and hydrogen, and then later on you could use some device that recombines the oxygen with the hydrogen and takes advantage of that energy. An example of that type of device that would do that would be a fuel cell, where you could use the hydrogen in a fuel cell to make electricity at night. And so that way you could make hydrogen during the day and then use it in a fuel cell to make electricity at night. And so several groups here at Stanford are working on this process, and we're collaborating with them in a DOE-funded center that's aimed at making efficient use of the sunlight to make fuels.
This sounds extremely fascinating, and I was very curious as to what type of materials they used for these processes.
Well, there's a range of materials we're using for both the water splitting and both parts of the water splitting, the oxygen and the hydrogen part of it. And we're looking at, in that regard, is some manganese oxide materials. So we've made nanoparticles of manganese, and then we carefully control the oxidation state of the manganese. And by doing so, we can control what phase our nanoparticles have. And working with Tom Aramillo's group in chemical engineering, we've demonstrated that they can have pretty good efficiencies in these types of reactions.
My next question was, how do they make nanoparticles in the lab?
And again, the process we go by to make nanoparticles is similar to sputter deposition. In fact, we use sputter deposition, but now we bleed in a lot more of the inert gas so that when the manganese atoms leave the chunk of manganese after they've been smacked by this ion, they cool quickly by colliding with these inert gas atoms. And then when they see another manganese atom, they condense with them into particles. And so we can make particles ranging from 1 nanometer on up to around 10 nanometers with this process.
This is all so fascinating that I had to ask, how do they measure nanometers?
Well, that's a good question, and it's one of the tricks of the trade. One of the ways we do it is during growth, we extract them through a hole or an orifice, and we ionize them and then run them through a device which selects them out by their mass. And so that way we can see how massive these particles are when they go through this device called a mass spectrometer. And other ways we do is we use various types of electron microscopy after synthesis. So we will deposit our nanoparticles onto a substrate of some kind and then put it in an electron microscope, either a scanning electron microscope, or if we really want to get detailed structural information and accurate size information, we'll use what's called a transmission electron microscope. And we're fortunate here at Stanford in that we have a really good nanocharacterization facility with state-of-the-art electron microscopes that allow us to characterize these nanostructured materials in this way. This is a facility that's run by Professor Bob Sinclair of Material Science and Engineering.
This research is extremely fascinating, especially in the choice of manganese, because manganese is widely available on Earth. I asked Professor Clemens why they chose to use manganese for this particular research.
Well, that was in Tom Jaramillo's group in chemical engineering. It was his idea. And he and his group were working on manganese and also in collaboration with Professor Stacy Bent in chemical engineering. And the three of us have been looking at this material from a bunch of different approaches. Tom and his group make it one way. Stacy Bent and her group make it with a process called atomic layer deposition, which is a really fascinating process that gives a great amount of control over the microstructure and nanostructure of materials. And then with our group, we started getting into this by using our nanoparticle generator to make manganese oxide nanoparticles.
The next fascinating research that I asked Professor Clemens about is carbon nanotubes. What are they and why are they important?
I currently don't have students working on this, but I've had a couple students looking at the process of carbon nanotube growth, and we've developed a relatively straightforward model to model the process. And I had a student who was a chemistry student working on a lot of the chemistry of using different precursors or organic molecules to make carbon nanotubes. They have a lot of really interesting properties, and they have interesting mechanical properties. And in fact, some of the work we did was in collaboration with NASA, where they had a long-term goal of making a space elevator using a carbon nanotube filament that could be launched into space and hung down to Earth, and you could pull satellites or instruments up this filament into space, like a space elevator. It's pretty science fiction-y, but it's a neat concept. So they have very interesting mechanical properties, and they also have really interesting chemical properties. And one of the projects we worked on was in collaboration with Anders Nielsen and Hanji Dai, both professors here at Stanford. Hanji Dai is in chemistry, and Anders is up at the SSRL, the Stanford Synchrotron Radiation Laboratory. And there we were looking at hydrogen storage on carbon nanotubes. And there had been some early work where people had reported huge amount of hydrogen stored on the surface of these carbon nanotubes. And we looked at that, and others had too, and looked at it and found out that in fact, those reports were wrong. And on bare nanotubes, there was very little hydrogen stored. But the difference that we did is we put nanoparticles on the carbon nanotubes. And this was based on some work that went on in Anders's group, where they discovered that if you put atomic hydrogen around carbon nanotubes, then the atomic hydrogen can bond to the carbon nanotube. So you have to break the molecule. So we decided we would put a catalyst on the carbon nanotubes that would assist in breaking the hydrogen molecules. We put palladium nanoparticles on the carbon nanotubes so the hydrogen molecules could come, be split by the palladium, and then transfer out and bond to the carbon nanotube. And we found that this increased the storage capacity of carbon nanotubes by a significant amount. Unfortunately, we never got the storage capacity high enough to be technologically useful. But it was interesting to see that you could have this spillover process occur where the hydrogen was split by the catalyst nanoparticles and then stored on the carbon nanotube.
Of course, I had to ask, if the carbon nanotube elevators were going to remain only a science fiction in space, or were we one day soon going to find that our next generation of elevators was going to be made of carbon nanotubes?
Yeah, I actually am not an expert in that aspect of carbon nanotube growth, but I think the idea is that these carbon nanotubes are incredibly strong, and in particular, they're very strong for their weight. And so if you want to have a space elevator where you have a filament that runs from space down to Earth, you need something that's lightweight in order to even support its own weight, and also very strong to support the loads that you're going to be sending up on this elevator. So it's an idea that's been around for some time. I don't know how close it is to realization. I suspect it's sometime in the future. The thing about putting it in space is that the end of the elevator could be a satellite in a geosynchronous orbit so that it could then be stationary on Earth so that you wouldn't have to catch it as it flew by.
After talking about the space elevator, I had to ask Professor Clemens about what kind of materials are used in spaceships.
Well, there's a huge range of materials that they make spaceships out of, and ranging from really lightweight metal alloys, including titanium and aluminum alloys, all the way to ceramic materials that they use in the heat shields, for example, on the space shuttle. And those are materials that are typically oxides. They can be lightweight, and they tend to be a little bit brittle, but they are capable of taking a very high temperature.
Hi, thank you so much for joining us today on Modern Tech News on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. Our guest, Professor Bruce Clemens, teaches materials science and materials research at Stanford University. He will now discuss the ion beam depositions and what they are used for.
One of the projects we're working on is actually using an ion beam approach to figure out how to make thin film silicon solar cells. So silicon turns out is a pretty good solar cell material in that it's earth abundant and people know how to make good solar cells out of it. The problem is the current processing involves taking big chunks of silicon that have been carefully processed and then sawing them up with a saw to make the solar cells. And you lose the saw blade kerf, they call it, and it's also expensive in terms of cost and energy. So what we're looking at is new ways to try to make silicon with that same degree of quality, crystalline quality, but in a more inexpensive process. And we're using ion beams to orient the grains or the crystals, the atomic arrangement of the silicon. And we fire an ion beam at our substrate during growth. And this orients the crystals to all be lined up with each other in an attempt to try to make higher quality thin film silicon. And we're looking at this for other materials as well.
Next, our guest, Professor Bruce Clemens, will describe what transistor gate materials are and why the transistor industry requires new research and new materials as the size of the transistors are getting small.
We have a project with Professor Nishi and his group in electrical engineering where we're looking at a new amorphous material to be incorporated into transistors. And this material is aimed at solving a problem that's arising as the transistors get smaller and smaller, and the grains of the metal that they're using now start to cause variability from device to device as the device sizes become comparable to the size of the grains in the metal. And our approach is to use an amorphous metal which doesn't have grains and so doesn't suffer from that problem and can have more consistent performance from device to device. And so his group and my group have worked together for the last 2 years on this new amorphous material for the metal gates in transistors.
After this great introduction to materials research and technology by Professor Bruce Clemens, I asked Professor Clemens what made him interested in materials science and why did he pursue materials research?
Well, that's a really good question. When I was an undergraduate, I didn't really know what I wanted to do when I grew up, and I still don't. But I majored in physics, or engineering physics, because I thought that would be widely applicable to a wide range of fields. So when I went to graduate school, I also majored in applied physics, thinking that I could go into a wide range of fields with that degree. As time went on, I got more and more interested in materials, starting with metallurgy classes as an undergraduate and then developing as I went to grad school and met up with my advisor and started working on amorphous materials and superconductors. And then my first job was at General Motors Research Lab. And again, it was in the physics department, but there I worked on thin films and it really started doing more and more material science. And so when I came here to Stanford, I was hired by the material science department, and I had sort of a distorted view of the field. I thought it was kind of like a branch of physics. But now that I've been here nearly 24 years, I am a dyed-in-the-wool material scientist and recognize that it exists as its own discipline. It's fascinating. It's the discipline where we look at the relationship between structure, processing, and properties of materials. And every aspect of engineering touches upon material science, almost every, because you eventually engineers have to make things, and you make things out of materials. And if you want to make them well, you have to understand the materials that you're making them out of, and you have to understand how to manipulate those materials to give you the properties you need and what characteristics of the materials do so.
At the beginning of the show, I mentioned that Professor Clemens teaches a course called Solar Cells, Fuel Cells, and Batteries, and that this quarter he has more than 10,000 students enrolled in this online class. I asked Professor Clemens to tell us how did the idea of this course develop, and how did he end up with 10,000 students?
Several years ago, I was having a discussion with my younger colleague, Professor Nick Malosh, in our department, and we decided that we should offer a course in our department on the material science associated with renewable energy. And so we agreed that this sounded like it would be a challenging endeavor, and Nick Malosh said, "You do it." So I did. So I started teaching this course called Solar Cells, Fuel Cells, and Batteries, Materials for the Energy Solution. And over the years, it's attracted a huge amount of interest from a very wide range of students, ranging from sophomores up to advanced graduate students, and covering, 12 or 13 different majors. So there's a lot of interest in this area from people with a wide variety of backgrounds. And I found that when I taught this class, this wide range of backgrounds presented a challenge to steer the class in a way that was useful to this audience. And typically in my lectures, I would have half the people bored and the other half the people lost. And there may be one person for whom the lecture was just right. So I started looking at new ways to deliver the course. It tends to be a large course, so getting personal attention to students was difficult. So I became intrigued by this idea of flipping the classroom. And in fact, my stepson, Drew, was the one who really started educating me about this. He's very interested in this aspect of education. So I thought this might be an opportunity to help with this class. So I thought, well, I'll record the lectures, and then the students who are bored by the lectures can play solitaire or cruise the internet while the lecture's playing on their computer. And the ones who are lost by the lectures can watch them and then rewind them and watch them again to get what I put in the lectures and understand it better. And that way, a wider range of students can assess the material. And then during class, we have problem sessions where the students get together in groups and they work on problems together. And then the TAs and I go around as a roving band of coaches to help them with the problems to get them the individual attention they need. So given that we were going to be doing that, we thought, well, why not offer this to the world? And so we have the lectures recorded. We've developed problem sets that can be answered online. And we had about 10,000 people sign up for the course, and we're just in our first week of it now and seeing how it's going. It's a very interesting experience, I have to say, to have students from around the world following the lectures. And I hope that we are able to produce something that's useful to a large number of people.
My next question, of course, was how can Professor Clemens and his teaching assistants possibly grade 10,000 students?
Well, we've been working with a group here on campus called Class2Go, and they've been working very hard to help us and others develop a platform that you can have questions that can be answered online. And my TAs, I have three really fantastic course assistants for the course, supported by the vice provost and also our department to help me with this. And we've been poring over the collection of problems that I have developed for the course over the years I've taught it and finding ones and modifying them so that they can be delivered in this way with short numerical answers. I've taught this course here on campus for about five or six years, but this is the very first time we're doing it this way, and it's the first time we're offering it as an online course.
So with the great success of online courses at Stanford, I had to ask Professor Clemens, how has technology changed education?
Well, I think most of the changes are in the fairly near future. Many of us still stand in front of a class and talk and write on a wall with a piece of chalk, which is something that humans started doing about 30,000 years ago. So the technology hasn't changed all that much, but it's changing very rapidly now. And I think the availability of high bandwidth internet and the availability of two-way communications and a capturing of content, disseminating content widely, and new developments are going to be changing education fundamentally in the next decade. And I think in 10 years from now, I personally feel that there's zero chance that education will be done in the same way it's done now. And I look at places like the Khan Academy, and I see that they're looking to change the world by offering a good education to everybody anywhere. I get really excited about that. And in my role as the Materials Research Society president, I also see that society is extremely excited about delivering content from our exciting meetings in new ways to people from around the world. So, and having two-way interactions even during the meetings with people who are unable to attend the meetings, for example. So I think it's a really exciting time in information and education. Exciting times mean it's sort of unsettling. I think we're going to be doing new things. We don't know exactly what we're going to be doing yet, but I think it'll be different.
Hi, you're listening to Modern Tech News on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. Our guest, Professor Bruce Clemens, teaches material science at Stanford University. And in this part of the show, we're talking about online education and technology in education, which made me ask Professor Clemens, how will online courses affect the value of education at an institution like Stanford?
Well, I think there's a lot more to an education at Stanford than the classes. As much work as we put into our classes and as much as we try to make them as good as possible, I think if you look at the value of a Stanford education, maybe the smaller part of that is what they get out of the classes, and the larger part is the colleagues they meet, the interactions they have, the personal face-to-face interactions they have with faculty and their fellow students. And as much as I think technology is going to change the world, I think there's no replacing a face-to-face interaction for establishing a relationship with a person. At least we don't have anything yet. I hope that technology can be used to maintain those relationships in a better way so that as travel gets more expensive, we're able to maintain a good connection throughout the world. But I think there's always going to be, I feel anyhow, with my crystal ball, which is as foggy as anybody's, that there'll always be a place like Stanford where scholars from around the world can convene, get to know each other, and work together towards a better education for everybody.
As I mentioned in the introduction, our guest, Professor Bruce Clemens, is this year's president of the prestigious Materials Research Society. Professor Bruce Clemens will now talk to us about the goals of the Materials Research Society and their plans to use online education and online outreach with the rest of the world.
The Materials Research Society is a society whose goal is to disseminate materials-related information through meetings and publications. And it's been around for, I think, around 50 years. I should know that exactly since I happen to be the president this year. It's a one-year term as president. And there's about 16 or 17,000 members, 40% of which are from places other than the U.S. We run a variety of scientific meetings, including our two big meetings, and one in spring and one in fall in San Francisco and Boston, respectively. And those meetings attract around 6,000 people for each of those meetings. But we also run a variety of other meetings around the world. The society has a board of directors, and as president, I've been involved with the board. And one of the things that the board is most excited about currently is this idea of using technology to craft new ways to deliver information.
Next, I had to ask, how do we find out more about the Materials Research Society?
Probably the best way is do a Google search on Materials Research Society. You'll come across our webpage, which has a whole host of things. It talks about the society and our meetings and also these outreach activities that the society does.
Hi, thank you so much for joining us today on Modern Tech News on KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM. Now it's time for our next PSA. On Saturday evening, November 17th at 8 p.m., the Palo Alto Philharmonic presents its fall chamber concert at the First Baptist Church in Palo Alto. The concert will feature quartets, trios, duets, and quintets performing old favorites and pieces you may not have heard before. For tickets or information for this November 17th chamber music concert by the Palo Alto Philharmonic at the First Baptist Church in Palo Alto, visit the Philharmonic's website at paphil.org. That's paphil.org. If you're interested in classical music, one of the best DJs in the Bay Area, Gary Lemko, has a great classical music show every Tuesday night from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Tune in to listen to Gary Lemko and the Music Treasury every Tuesday from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. A little earlier, as we discussed online education, Professor Clemens mentioned the Khan Academy. I wanted to know what Professor Clemens thought that the Khan Academy was doing right in terms of reaching children all over the world with online education.
There's a huge range of applications that can be imagined for technology and education. And I mentioned Khan Academy because I happen to know just a little bit about it because through, again, being educated by my stepson, who was an intern there this summer and is working with them. But I think that this idea of a flipped classroom is a piece of their vision, and this enables kids to have a variety of learning speeds to be accommodated without having to be locked to the rigid pace of a fixed academic schedule. So if a kid's gifted, they can zoom ahead on their own and the teacher can help coach them with personal interactions. They can get the material through technology. And then if a student maybe takes a little longer to grasp a concept but is perfectly capable of grasping it and may even think about it in new ways once they do grasp it, but not quite as quick, they can also be accommodated by this approach too. So I think it has a way of being more inclusive to a wider range of students. And I think it's an exciting thing also for delivering course materials to parts of the world where education isn't as well developed. I'm excited about it. I think it's an exciting vision. And I think, you know, Khan Academy is just one example. There's Coursera, which was started here at Stanford. It's a private company that is looking to deliver college-based materials from a wide variety of universities to students around the world. And then the Stanford one here, Class2Go, is another example of using technology to help deliver a better class on campus here, but also to deliver content to people around the world.
My next question to Professor Clemens was about the outreach to the community by Stanford professors and Stanford students.
Faculty members do this individually here. Many of us serve as judges for science fairs, for example, or go to classrooms with demonstrations. Also, there's a program here at Stanford where we bring high school teachers in to our labs for the summer, and we get them an experience with research that then they can share and use to help them develop curriculum to get students excited about it. I personally think that this sort of outreach is extremely important to get kids excited about science. I remember when I was a kid, the developments of space and rockets and so forth got a whole generation excited about science. And I think now the science is, and engineering is just as important, maybe more important than ever. And I think we miss out on some really talented students who don't get fired up about science. So I think it's important to do this. And that, again, that's one of the activities that the Materials Research Society engages in. And I'll just one plug for them. They have this traveling museum called Strange Matter, which goes around to places around the world now and draws record audiences into these technological museums to show people about materials and the interesting world of materials. We've also run a NOVA series called Making Stuff that was offered by PBS, and it was quite fun and good too.
I next wanted to discuss what attracts younger students and young children to study science.
You know, like I mentioned, when I was a kid, it was the possibility of space, and I remember standing out on my front lawn and looking up and watching Sputnik go by, then watching all the science fiction and reading lots of science fiction books and imagining the possibilities that exist. And I think that got a lot of youth fired up with the possibilities for exciting things in the future. And now what I see in the world is more worry about the future. We're worried that we're heating the globe up by our carbon emissions, and we're worried that there's too many people, we're damaging the environment. And I think that's a less effective approach for getting people excited about things. So what I try to look at is new possibilities. Now, and if you look at it, we use a ton of energy. The world uses an amazing amount of energy. One time I sat down and did a calculation and I converted the world's energy use to oil. And then I compared the amount of oil we use to Lake Tahoe. And Lake Tahoe is a huge, beautiful lake, one of the deepest lakes in the country. And I figured out that if you converted all the energy that the world uses to the equivalent amount of oil, we'd fill up Lake Tahoe every 4 days. So that's a huge infrastructure that exists to deliver this energy that we're using. And we want to change that. We want to change it to be a more modern, less environmentally damaged, and more sustainable approach. So that involves a massive undertaking. And we're doing it. I think it's slower than many of us would wish, but we're starting to do energy in new ways, the biggest changes that I've seen in my lifetime. So those are exciting changes. Another thing that's exciting is transportation. I have a book that I've had for decades, and it's about the electric car. And I think it was written in the 60s. And the whole premise of the book is the electric car is just around the corner. But now we see electric cars coming along and battery technology is getting better and better. And so we're changing, and we're going to be changing the transportation methods in a fundamental way for the first time in decades too. And along those lines, these autonomous cars that people are developing are giving the possibility for new ways to move cars around the planet. So I think those kinds of things are exciting. We're developing new ways to stay connected with people. And I think that that's captured the attention of a lot of the young people these days and old as well. So I think focusing on the positive possibilities and also just getting students the idea that science is fun. It's like figuring stuff out. You get to look at how something behaves in nature and try to figure out in a way that allows you to make predictions for how it's going to behave in the slightly different condition or a different condition. And then you get to test that and see if your prediction works. And it's really, really fun. So I think getting that across to students is exciting, too. Too often we tend to throw a bunch of development at them. You have to learn this math. You have to learn these fundamental principles before you can have the fun. But I think if we can convey to them that, hey, this is really fun. What we do day to day is we have fun doing it. We want to know what's going on. And that's what I love to see in my students, too, is when they just have to know what's going to happen. And they've got to know this. And once you see that spark of curiosity happen in a student, there's no holding them back. And so I think that's what we have to excite in our younger generation.
Professor Clemens does a lot of fundamental research, and his group is trying to find solar cells that are much more economical than the ones that are now on the market. I asked Professor Clemens if he thought that we are spending enough on fundamental research in order to solve the world's energy problems.
We are not spending enough. And I believe that if you look at it carefully, you will find that every dollar we spend on fundamental research comes back manyfold and increases in the economy. And so it's not a handout, it's an investment. And I think it's an investment for our future that we should be making, and we should be doing more of it. And that sounds self-serving, because when the government spends more on research, it makes my life easier. But it's also something that I really think is true. I think it's be for the better of the country and better for the world if we were to spend more money on fundamental research. I mean, the infrastructure that we're trying to impact is huge. And if you want to change the way that the world's energy system works, it's going to be a massive undertaking, the like of which we've rarely seen humans undertake. And I think it's going to take some real leadership to accomplish it.
Professor Clemens mentioned that he has been at Stanford for almost a quarter of a century. I asked Professor Clemens, have the students changed during that time?
Well, I think if you go back through history, you'll find that old guys like me always look at the young students and say, they're not like they were when I was a kid. And I think even Aristotle felt that way. So there's this dangerous tendency to think, oh, the students aren't quite as tough as they were when I was a kid. But, you know, the students I work with are absolutely fantastic. They're very creative. They're excited about things. They're always thinking, and they're a joy to work with. So I don't want to say that they've got any better or worse. I think they're thinking about things in different ways. And I think the students that I work with now have more of their own ideas about how things should work rather than when I was a student, I was sort of looking at the system and my environment, the universities I was in, to try to figure out how I fit into that and how I could work within that system. And I think the students nowadays are thinking more of how can this system work for me and how can what I want to do be accomplished within the system. So I think in some ways they're more mature than I was anyhow as a student. They certainly have greater access to information than I did. And on the other hand, I had more time to cure my own boredom, and that led to explorations of the type that current students may not be exposed to. So I think there's differences, and it's exciting to see how it's developing.
My next question was, what were the science books that most influenced Professor Clemens?
I've read several books about the aspect of global warming, and I always enjoy Oliver Sacks's books. There was one, I believe, called Uncle Tungsten that really gave a vision of how a mind can be interested in science. And I think that was a good book for understanding the fascination of science.
And my last question to Professor Clemens was, how can people keep in touch with his research, and what would be the best way to get in touch with him?
Well, the easiest way to find me is on the Internet. If you do a Google search of my name, you'll come up with my webpage and my email address. And right now I get tons of emails, but I try to get to the ones that people send to me to contact me personally eventually.
Hi, we hope you enjoyed today's show on Modern Tech News. We would like to thank our guest, Professor Bruce Clemens, very, very much. It has been a great honor and privilege to have Professor Bruce Clemens as our guest. Professor Clemens teaches materials research and science at Stanford University, and he's also the president of the very prestigious Materials Research Society for 2012-2013. Thank you again for joining us today. You've been listening to Modern Tech News, KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM.